My calculations are correct.
Wait a minute, Doc.
When this baby hits 88 miles per hour...
Are you telling me you built a time machine?
You're gonna see some serious shit.
Out of a DeLorean?
Jock, you've got to come back with me.
Where?
Back to the future!
Hey, Cornies, welcome to Sideshow. I'm Jock.
I'm Joe.
And last week we indulged both ourselves, both Star Wars guys, but mostly me with my ranking of Star Wars. This week it's all Joe. Well, it's a reverse. I like it too, but nowhere to the level that you do. And of course, with Doc Brown here by our side, we are going to talk Back to the Future trilogy. Because here on Carnival Personnel, we have our thumb on today, the present, the now. You know.
Well, you're not far off because if you've seen every commercial lately for, you know, whether it be the movie Ready Player One.
Yes.
Or like there's like some sort of a Capital One commercial or something that they feature. The DeLorean is basically like the de facto cool car in any pop culture referenced commercial or whatnot.
I will tell you, and we talked about this a number of times, all seriousness. Management's dream car is a DeLorean. Like, honestly, if I ever show up with a DeLorean, that's it. Like, yeah. I can show up in a DeLorean with a mistress, and it's all good if I say, here's your DeLorean. I'm taking the slut. You have the car. We call it even.
It is the shittiest car ever manufactured.
No, because each DeLorean came with 12 grams of cocaine.
Right. But yeah, that's actually... Okay, so to start things off, the DeLorean... we all know what the DeLorean is. That's a car that was manufactured in 1981 by John DeLorean and the DeLorean Manufacturing Company, or the Motor Company. And it's featured as the vehicle of choice that Dr. Emmett Brown decides to build his time machine out of in the movie Back to the Future.
In 1984, was a DeLorean...
85.
85. Thank you. A cool car, or at that point, was it a joke?
It was kind of a joke. Yeah, and I think they chose it because, A, it looked futuristic because it plays into a plot point in the movie where when Marty goes, Marty McFly. Oh, boy, we're getting into the
spoilers. I just want to put out there that if you haven't seen the trilogy, this is going to be a spoiler rampant podcast.
All right, so Back to the Future is my favorite movie of all time.
It is.
The favorite
movie. Not Ghostbusters.
No, Ghostbusters close second. Back to the Future, my favorite. I could watch that movie until I die.
We should go see it together sometime.
We should. We really, really. And that and Goonies. If we can somehow bookend those two movies together.
Okay, now my question before, and we'll go in order of the movies. Did you see Back to the Future Part One first?
Yes.
You did?
Yes. The television, edited for television version, when it appeared on the NBC Sunday Night Movie, starring Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd.
What year is that?
1980, was it 87? I think it came on TV in 87. And what's notable about the made-for-TV version is that they actually did film, like, alternate versions of the, you know, they had television versions of the swear points in the movie. So when Doc Brown sends his dog Einstein 1 minute into the future as the test pilot for the DeLorean, Marty McFly says, "Jesus Christ, you just disintegrated Einstein." "Don't worry, Marty, I didn't disintegrate anybody." The line in the made-for-TV movie version was, or the TV version was, "Geez Louise, Doc, you just disintegrated Einstein." And it's not an overdub. It's an actual, like, retaping of that.
Did the actors come back in and do
it? No. They filmed it knowing that, okay, we're going to make a regular version. And then here's the made-for-TV points because we're going to obviously, you know, syndicate this. That's getting into the minutiae. Let's talk about the broadness of Back to the Future and its impact on pop culture now, back then, time travel genres in general. This is the ultimate time travel movie. They've attempted time travel shit before Back to the Future, you know, with H.G. Wells' Time Machine, which was, you know, fantastic in and of its day. They had that TV show in the 60s called Time Tunnel. It was an Irwin Allen production, the Lost in Space guy. You know, that was a thing. Like, those were all, like, fantastic journeys. Like, you know, we're a group of white men who are going to go into the future or into the past, like the distant future or the distant past. And it was all fantastic. Nothing relatable. This was essentially born out of, the story goes, Bob Gale, who wrote Back to the Future, co-wrote it with Robert Zemeckis, the director. He was looking through his parents' yearbooks. He looked through and he saw his parents' pictures. And he was about a little bit, maybe a little bit older than they were in the photos. And he was like, I wonder if I went to school with my dad, would I be friends with him? And that was sort of the germ for this movie. It's just like this kid, this teenager from the 80s, has like this nerdy father and this kind of depressed alcoholic mother. And, you know, they're in their 40s. But he interacts with the teenage versions of them and basically becomes an integral part of their alternate lives via the time traveling. So that was kind of the beginning of Back to the Future. That was the sort of the plot point. And I think that's what made the time travel relatable to most people. It wasn't like, oh, the distant future or the distant past. It was like, no, 30 years back, you know, running into your parents as teenagers, what would that have been like? And what consequences would that have on your life if you were to make any changes to your parents before you were even born? Like, how does that affect things? And yeah, so that sort of changed the idea of like how time travel stories would be written from then on.
Was it written as a trilogy?
No, it was actually written as just a one-off.
And it's one of those Hollywood things where, like, you know, Pacific Rim is coming out, you know, and it's like, I wish they had left it alone, but it's like, it did so well, you can't not. The 300.
Oh, like Avatar.
Right.
Oh, we're going to make four more. Really?
Well, you know, but seriously, like, you know, 300, everybody dies at the end. Spoiler again, you know. And so they had to go and do a prequel with all this stuff. But with that, so there was no thought.
No, actually, so what's interesting about that is that at the end of Back to the Future Part 1, there is, you know, we got to do something about your kids, Marty. And Marty and his girlfriend, Jennifer, go into the future with Doc Brown to do something.
She was going to marry a black guy.
To do something about
that. That was on Family Guy.
Oh, right.
Family Guy, Marty right. Shows back up. And he's like, we got to do something. What about, your daughter's about to marry a black guy. And they're like, yeah, we're okay with that.
By the way, I do want to say, sidebar, thanks for that. There's got to be some enterprising fan of Family Guy out there that can maybe recreate the entire Back to the Future movie using only references to the movie done in Family Guy. Because Family Guy's referenced that movie in some way,
almost
shape, or form.
Almost episode.
Yeah, almost like, you know, yeah, like every scene in Back to the Future, for the most part, has been referenced somehow by Family Guy. I know Alex Sulkin, who is one of the executive producers of Family Guy, that's his favorite movie of all time as well. So shout out to Alex Sulkin, at the Sulk on Twitter. But anyways, so what was I saying? So yeah, so you were getting to your point about whether this was going to be a trilogy or not. At the end of the first movie, it just goes to credits as the DeLorean flies into the screen. When it was released on television, when I first saw it, it said to be continued. And that, I think that was put on because they knew they were going to be developing a sequel. And that was what is attached to all the home video releases, is that there's that little to be continued thing, because they knew that in 1989, they were going to release to the world Back to the Future Part 2. But we'll get to that in a moment. What are your questions on Back to the Future? Because I can answer all of them.
Okay. It's one of those things. And we've talked about this before in our podcast because we reference it a lot because it's your favorite movie. We went to it last year. In retrospect, does it hold up?
Absolutely.
And I'm just not poking holes. I'm not being that guy. But we have talked about this. Like with Grease, when you see it as a teenager and then when you see it as adults, it's like, wait a minute. Biff tried to rape your mom.
Yeah, there are awful points that there's the whole – even at the time, I mean, when they were pitching this movie to all these studios, Disney, among others, turned down developing this movie because they didn't want incest. Essentially, his teenage mother – is in love with her future teenage son and infatuated by him. And that was just too creepy for a lot of studios.
And that scene at the end, again, spoiler alert, where she kisses him and then it's just...
Yeah, she kisses him. They're in there's a whole point in the movie where they're at the dance and Marty's her date to the dance and they pull up in the car and they park which is what the kids did in the 50s. They would make out in the parking lot.
After smoking and drinking.
Right. And then she leans in to kiss him because he's supposed to be setting up this situation where George McFly, his future dad, would come in and rescue her from this, you know, this handsy cretin who she thought was great but really is not. But for the most part, it turns out that she is the more aggressive one. So she leans in and kisses him, and she stops and she looks at him and she goes, "This is wrong. I don't know what it is, but when I'm kissing you, it's like I'm kissing my brother." And that might be a little hard for you to understand. No, believe me, it makes perfect sense.
I almost walked over your line. Sorry.
That's all right.
But yeah, it's like, I remember, and then at the end of the movie when it's, you know, all put together and an author and successful business person, George McFly, and he has Biff out there washing his car. It's like, yeah, I'm not sure if anybody tried to rape my wife or then girlfriend and your future wife, if I would have that person, you know, kind of hanging around my children 20 years later.
Right. Well, you know, he was reformed. He was never brought up on charges, apparently. But that was the way it was in the 50s. Bullies raped.
Yeah. Oh, come on. Just lay back and, you know.
All right. So that aside.
So
social mores aside.
We used to go to Universal about once a month, you know, a couple times a month. No matter how many times I did the tram ride, it's one of my favorite things. And when they take you through the old back lot where the square is and everything like that, I always got a little giddy. I love that. And then they would always play clips and outtakes from the movie. That scene where you know, Michael J. Fox and his, you know, Leah Thompson are in the car and she's drinking, and he's like, "You drink?" And she hands it to him, and he takes a swig. You know this. It's actually alcohol, but Michael J. Fox was expecting water.
Yeah.
But they wanted to get, like, a really great take.
Spit take, yeah.
And so he had no idea that it was.
Yeah, that was real alcohol. So, yeah, that's a great scene. But, I mean, let's just talk about – I don't know where to begin with Back to the Future.
I'm going
to
ask you a bunch of questions.
Yeah, thank you.
You go back in time, and you find out that your dad – I mean, neither one of us have our dads on pedestals, but it's like, at least my dad, I'm hoping, wasn't a creepy peeping Tom fucking, you know.
Yeah, he was like he was a creepy dude. Yeah.
Like absolutely. I mean, great. His writing was, you know, sci-fi, and he had this creative thing, and that's kind of cool. But if I went back in time and my dad was George McFly, I'd probably beat the shit out of him, too. I'm pretty sure it was one of those things where if anybody was asking for a wedgie, like, it was George McFly.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, well, you know, he was a nerdy guy. But then, of course, it took his son to coax him out of his shell and become a thriving member of society and to have confidence in himself.
And the whole juxtaposition where he had to get his parents together because he ruined the moment when his parents met, which is when his father fell out of a tree and got hit by his father-in-law's car, who brought him in to nurse him back
Stella!
To health.
Another one of these damn kids jumped in front of my car!
Another one.
You know, the little things you pick up in the movie when you watch it 600,000 times,
and it is great. And it's funny when you said that it's your favorite movie. I remember, what is it, 92, 93, doing formal edition stuff with you where you recreate it. There was a skit where you were recreating your line, George.
Right. Yes, yeah. Hey, you, get your damn hands off her. You really think I had to swear? Yes, definitely. God damn it, George, swear.
So, Crispin Glover, he had a small window where he was great.
Yeah.
But he is fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, the David Letterman appearance was the culmination of his fuck-uppery.
And I can kick? he put out an album that I think I just got rid of, or I still have like a couple albums. I don't know if I gave it where it was great. I mean, he does... go to YouTube. I'm quite sure you can do it, or Google it. You know, he does a cover of "These Boots Are Made for Walking." Mwah, magnificent. But back to the movie. It's like, and so you know, I've heard people like Neil deGrasse Tyson do their talk on this, his take on their take of time travel. So Marty McFly goes back in time. He plays Chuck Berry in front of his cousin, who then calls Chuck Berry to tell him.
That there's a
so how would Chuck Berry have gotten to be Chuck Berry if Marty McFly? You know that new sound you said you were. It's your cousin.
Yeah, yeah.
Marvin.
Yeah, your cousin Marvin Berry. Yeah, I know. There's a lot.
Explain.
There's a lot of paradoxes in that movie. I mean, just the fact that he goes back in time and he gives Doc Brown. So Doc Brown in the original timeline, which catapults Marty back into time, is that he gets shot by Libyan terrorists whom he stole from them a case of plutonium, which he needed to power the vehicle because this sucker's electrical. He just needs a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity. Anyways, he gets shot, and throughout the whole movie, Marty's back in 1955. He runs into the younger Doc and convinces him who he is and where the time machine is and all that stuff. But at the same time, he's also trying to warn him of this, you know, impending doom. And at one point in the movie, at the climax of the movie, he hands him a letter that has information that Doc Brown doesn't know about. He tears it up. Marty goes back into the future, and then he runs into himself. If you remember the scene,
yep.
He runs into himself getting back into the DeLorean in 1985 in the Twin Pine Mall, now Lone Pine Mall parking lot, and then going back into 1955, thereby, in theory, completing the circle of time travel. So then now Marty Prime goes and encounters Doc and gives him the letter. And he finds out that he didn't tear up the letter after all. So just the fact that Marty met up with Doc, a couple of things. He shouldn't – when he meets Marty McFly in reality, like say like 1980, for example, he meets Marty McFly. Like he knows that that's Marty McFly from the future. Like he's eventually going to be building a time machine. Like does he befriend him? By the way, it's a little creepy to have – you know, maybe a teenage boy, you know, hanging around like a 60-something-year-old guy who lives by himself.
As creepy as the Thanksgiving episode of Formal Edition.
Okay, what do you want? How many tangents do you want to take this on?
I'm just saying.
Right. But, I mean, like that in and of itself is weird. Like, obviously, him going back to the past should have altered his entire future.
So Marty's day starts by going over to Doc Brown's house before school.
Right. And all of his clocks are set back 20 minutes because there was some stupid experiment, essentially to make Marty late for school.
But then it's great. He rushes to high school, and it turns out he has the same principal that his dad had 20-some years earlier.
Principal Strickland. Jesus, didn't this guy ever have hair? He was, but it played by the great James Tolkien.
What do you like best about it?
About what?
When you first saw it.
Oh, just the idea that a car could be a time machine and you can go back and interact with the recent past, you know, and just, you know, make changes in things that, you know, maybe make corrections, do-overs. Everybody wants a do-over. Everybody can relate to the do-over. Like, you know, if I only had it to do over again, you know, could I?
So the sequel, does it hold up?
The sequel is flawed. And it's not very good.
Sequels, sorry.
Well, let's go to part two. So part two, they were filming parts two and three simultaneously.
Well, at this point, I mean, the actors were huge and they weren't going to be able to lock them up three years later.
And by the way, they were getting a little long in the tooth. He was playing a teenager. Michael J. Fox was still trying to play an 18-year-old in 1985. So if they were going to turn out two movies.
And that'd be a little shaky.
Shut up. So anyways, so they were filming both part two and three simultaneously. Now, the part two, we all know, if we've seen part two, it's a little confusing. It's a little convoluted. And there's a major, major time travel plot hole that fucks up the whole movie. And that is, of course, when old Biff from the year 2015, the plot of the movie is that it takes place where the first movie left off. They go to the future to help with Marty's kids. Long story short, they solve that problem, but they have to leave the time machine behind Doc and Marty so that they can rescue Jennifer because she was mistakenly taken by police to – she had been passed out and they took her to her future home thinking she was the older Jennifer because of thumbprint technology. Anyways, Biff hijacks the car.
That's how they get
you. Old Biff hijacks the car. He somehow figures out how time travel works. No, just learning for the first time that there's a time machine. So the logistics of him knowing how the time machine works, how to set the coordinates, how to get that the car, in order to achieve time travel, has to go 88 miles per hour.
Yeah, but everybody knows that.
Oh, yeah, 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 exactly. I guess by 2015, time travel was
he
like,
saw the first movie.
But then, okay, granted, that is ridiculous. But then the major, 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 major plot hole is that he uses the time machine to deliver his younger self a sports almanac from the future that gives him the scores on every major sporting event. Very thin, by the way. Very thin almanac for something that's supposed to give you the scores of every major sporting event in the years 1950 through the year 2000.
Thinner or thicker than the Book of Great Jewish Sports Legends?
Shut up. Right, that's from the movie there. But anyways, he gives him his younger self the book so that he can become richer in the future. Okay, that in and of itself is also fucked up because his older self is still the older self from the original history. It's not like his, you know, his logic is flawed. Let's say, you know, the old Biff is not going to automatically snap into this wealthy guy. He's just going to become another version of his older self. But then he comes back and returns the vehicle to the year 2015. Now, obviously, if he had given Biff the almanac, young Biff the almanac in 1955, he would have then changed history, meaning that if he departs from alternate 1955, he has to arrive in alternate 2015, the one where Biff is essentially Donald Trump on steroids and runs.
Same hair.
Exactly. But he should not have returned to the original history where Doc and Marty had left the DeLorean unattended.
Right.
So that's a huge plot hole. There's no reconciling that. It's just sort of like, oh, fuck you. This is the – we got to make this work.
That's not what hyperspace looks like.
Exactly. It's one of those things. So you have to sort of forgive that. But the great thing about this movie is that they get to return into the original movie where they have to go back to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance from 1955. And then Marty –
is that the snowball?
No. And okay. Then Marty has to avoid running into his other self because they're back in the same history that they've – created from the first movie.
And that's fun.
Yes, and it is fun. And it also started a lawsuit and then a law. It's sort of like a rule in Hollywood because Crispin Glover did not sign on for the sequels. However, his likeness did. They used his likeness in a couple of scenes in Back to the Future 2, and Crispin Glover sued successfully.
Oh.
And they had to change... You know,
did
how,
they take him out?
They had to, you know, going forward, they had to, you know, all movies made going forward had to, they basically said, like, you can't just, you know, use somebody's likeness and whatever without their permission. And there was, like, rights and residuals and all that stuff. But then that leads into Back to the Future Part 3. Where I don't even know how we want to get into Back to the Future Part 3, which you have not seen yet.
I've seen parts, but seriously, honestly, we saw Back to the Future, but before Back to the Future came out, from 98 to maybe late 90s, I almost saw no movies. Like I just was doing other things. I mean, I think you can count the movies, the number of movies I saw in one hand in a theater, you know, at the time. And it's not like, oh, I had such a cool life. I didn't have time for traveling. I just, you know, just didn't. And so by the time, you know, it came out and stuff like that, and it wouldn't have been something that I had to go and see. It wasn't my genre, you know.
It wasn't your Star Wars.
It was not my Star Wars. You know what was my Star Wars?
Star Wars.
Thank you. But yeah, but I know enough, and I'm, you know, and I think it's hysterical and great, and we joke about that. Management and I have referenced it 1,000 times. The note that they gave Great Western, not Western,
Western Union
and stuff like that. Because the thing is, Western Union, and I remember talking about this a lot in Qatar. Western Union is huge there. People still use it all the time. When's the last time you've seen a Western Union here?
Oh, right, exactly. They're cash checking places, essentially.
Yeah. But like Western Union was that big, and the whole joke is like that. Here's this letter 100 years later that they actually delivered.
Right. We also want to talk a little bit about the future, and let's talk about the 2015 of Back to the Future Part 2.
Okay, so How close were they with everything?
From, yeah, like what did they get right? What did
they get right? Yeah.
What did they get right? I'm trying to remember if there's anything that they really nailed.
Voice activated TV.
Right. Oh, they had widescreen televisions. They had voice activated TVs. They got by 1 year, the Cubs winning the World Series. But what else? What they got wrong, I can point out. They were USA Today was the number one newspaper. What's a newspaper, you ask? They didn't have the internet. Like they couldn't predict the internet. They had, if you notice, there's the back alley scene where they put sleeping Jennifer. They knock her out so that she doesn't interfere with their plans, and they set her down in an alley. Very courteous of them. They didn't really know where else to put her, but they set her back in like this sort of like trash pickup area. But it's all repackaged LaserDiscs and CDs. Like LaserDiscs were going to be like the medium, the disposable right. media of the time, but that didn't happen. What else?
Not yet.
Right, not yet. Flying cars obviously didn't happen. Hoverboards.
Cheated. I feel cheated. And there's nothing worse. You want to make management lose their shit? You know those things that they call hoverboards?
Oh, those are awful.
Refer to one of those as a hoverboard.
Right.
And get the noise canceling headphones ready, because you are in for a world of hurt. There's nothing that sets her off quicker than when you call those hoverboards.
Right. And they also had, every house had a fax machine. They thought that, oh, in Japan in 1980s, every house had a fax machine. So they just figured that trend would carry over to the United States.
Funny enough, I actually needed a fax machine for the first time in like a decade this week, and I had to drive all over the place till I could finally find one. Wow. Literally, I had to fax. We live in a world where, like, the one place I had to fax something, I'm like, can I just take a picture of this and email it or text it now?
Another thing they did get sort of right was when old Biff has to pay the taxi cab and he has to thumbprint his payment. That's sort of like Apple Pay now.
Yeah.
You know, you can just use thumbprint technology. So there's a couple of things that they kind of nailed, but then yeah, a lot of it's like, oh, you know, it's hard to predict the future, apparently. But what I did to wrap up Back to the Future Part 2, my favorite part of Back to the Future Part 2 is not so much the movie as in the actual year and date in 2015 when Jimmy Kimmel decided to reunite Doc Brown and Marty McFly on his stage with the DeLorean. They arrive on. Did you see this?
Did.
Yes. So they arrive on stage.
I think you sent me a link.
I had to, I think I forced you with your eyelids forced open to watch it.
Little Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. You know, but I gave you the Visine. You're okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that was one of my favorite moments from the year 2015. But anyway, so Back to the Future 2 ends with Doc Brown getting sent back to the year 1885 because his time circuits were on the fritz throughout the entire movie. And then this is also another plot hole. He gets sent back in time because he gets struck by lightning. Okay? Now, we all know that from the first movie, they needed the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity just to power the flux capacitor, which is what makes time travel possible.
We all know that.
Yes. You also need to go 88 miles per hour. The car was not going 88 miles per hour when he was struck by lightning. How did he travel back in time, you ask? Well, Bob Gale had an answer. When he was pressed at some Q&A, he's like, well, the force of the blowback from being struck by lightning accelerated the car to 88 miles per hour, thereby sending him back to the future.
That's not what hyperspace
That's looks bullshit. Like. That is such fucking bullshit. Anyways, so he gets sent back to the Old West, which is funny because then a minute later, Joe Flaherty shows up from Western Union with a letter from the Old West that they held on to for 70 years to be delivered to a Marty McFly standing on this very spot at this very exact time. And the letter explains how he's been living in the Old West. Again, another screwy thing because, all right, so they sent him back in time. So now his timeline instantly changed now because of the actions that, you know what I mean? So it's
right.
he should not have been affected. Like that Marty should not have been affected by sending Doc Brown back in time, but yet he was.
You know, in present day, the Flash is all time travel and stuff. And they go well out of their way to explain, okay, when he went back in time, this changed this, but there's a time remnant from him. And it's like, I like the show The Flash, but sometimes I'm like, I'm going to lay down now.
Right, exactly. Now I've gone cross-eyed.
So there's three Barry Allens in this room, and this one is from Earth 4, and this one is a time remnant from the Barry from Earth 2, who's now the bad guy trying to kill Barry in Earth 1 because the Flash. Okay, I'm just going to go watch, I don't know, a Brian Regan stand up.
The first rule of time travel is that there are no rules of time travel.
Right. There's not. Don't talk about time travel.
Yeah, exactly. But so part three takes place in the Old West because upon learning that, first of all, Marty is stuck in 1955, alternate 1955 now, because he doesn't have a time machine. But he does know where to get one. He goes to the 1955 Doc Brown. And then based on the letter, they discover that the old DeLorean is in a cave, and they excavate the cave, and they get the old DeLorean up and running. But then at the same time, they find out that Doc Brown, I'm not going to ruin the movie for you, but Doc Brown gets shot in the Old West. Like almost like 4 months into living in the Old West, he gets shot by an ancestor of Biff Tannen named Mad Dog Tannen. Because Jacques has not seen Back to the Future.
So a long line of douchebags.
Exactly. Right. Right.
O'Doyle, I feel you. <going down. laughs>
But so, yeah. So now Marty feels compelled to go back, not to the future. He's going to go back to the 1880s and save Doc from getting killed, you know, and cut short of his, you know, basically his retirement. He was going to retire in the Old West. And, you know, then he learns that he actually gets killed. So then that's where the whole plot of the movie takes place. But he also, Doc Brown, falls in love with a woman named Clara, played by Mary Steenburgen. And it's a touching kind of ribbon to put on the whole, you know, spectrum of things because, you know, George and Lorraine find true love in their relationship, and Marty and Jennifer find true love in their relationship. And Doc is just sort of twisting in the wind, like always married to the science, you know, to science.
He was science.
Science. But he never had, a significant other, and he had to go back in time to find one. And it was, one of those love at first sight things. And it's actually a very touching moment. It's great. Watching this movie and watching that relationship, like I actually get kind of misty-eyed at the end of Back to the Future Part 3. I won't spoil it for you because I'm gonna force-feed him Back to the Future Part 3. It's maybe I'll let him out of the house tonight. Maybe I'll, you know, send it home with him. I don't know. It's a nice wrap-up, and it's a Western. The whole movie's a Western.
So you not a big fan of 2?
I don't think anybody's a big fan of 2.
Big fan of 3?
My ranking is 1, 3, 2.
And what's the gap between 1 and 3?
Two.
Are they close? No. It's like number one is your all-time favorite movie.
Right.
Is number three in your top 10?
No. I mean, I would say that like part three is, you know, it's in the top 25, I guess. I don't know. It's like not a fantastic movie only because it redoes a lot of stuff from the first movie, but it does it differently. It adds a new element, but it does add a new element and some character growth to both Doc Brown and Marty. They have some, you know, Marty has this thing where it's shown in part two that people call him chicken and he gets fucked up about it. Like, you know, he gets challenged, like, nobody calls me chicken. Like, he can't back down from a fight. Like, that's what fucks him up in the future or in his alternate future or whatever. So that's explored a little bit more deeply, but it's not my top five movies.
No, it's what I love about different kinds of films. And I think, you know, you've already touched on it. One of the great things is Back to the Future. It's stood the test of time. I mean, it's referenced to this day in everything. My kids know, except they see a DeLorean in anything and they know when it's where it's from. Also, you know, it really was groundbreaking as far as like time travel and such a mainstream like thing. I mean, I don't think time travel has been a thing in science fiction before that, but not to this level. Everybody knows the pillars and the rules of the principle set forth in this. So, no, I think something like that is great. And also, what's interesting, the court case with Crispin Glover. I mean,
I don't even know if it was a court case, but, you know, yeah.
I'm gonna read up on that tonight because that's what I do, and I like to find this stuff out. But that's one of the things. It's really interesting that was the movie that changed things, you know. So they changed things in front of the camera and behind the camera. So those are the stories that I love.
Yeah, I mean, and then, like, just I guess now we could probably talk about a little bit about just like the culture around Back to the Future, like the fandom of Back to the Future. I mean, there are people now who scour the earth looking for any and every DeLorean left available on the planet just so they can retrofit it to look like the Back to the Future car.
And we talked about this past summer, Joe took his kids and I took my kids, seven of us went. Management went yes. So there was seven of us there, and it was really funny. It's like they advertised this 80s night, and they had the Goonies and Back to the Future, and Joe and I took a couple pictures in front of a DeLorean, and it was a regular DeLorean, which in itself, there's no such thing as a regular DeLorean. All DeLoreans are cool. You open it up, or the door was open, and there was like a camera in the front seat.
Yep.
But then we saw like 50 yards behind, there was a whole setup.
Like the official Back to the Future replica car, or what, one of the replica cars.
They had wax figures of Doc and Marty.
Yep.
They had all the Einstein. They had an Einstein, in there and all this thing. And what's interesting when you said people scour, so it was a fundraising thing. You didn't have to give money to take your picture with it, but I forget what they were raising funds for.
How can you forget what they were raising funds for? Okay. You make 8,000 jokes about it a podcast. Michael J. Fox's Michael J.
Oh,
Fox.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, the Michael J. Fox Foundation.
Okay, I was going to say something.
Oh, no, the Parkinson's. Yeah. Parkinson's. Well, I mean, that was,
But crazy we were talking to those people who, and they also had props from something else. Oh,
Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park. They had a Jeep. And they do an event almost every weekend. They're booked to something. They go somewhere almost every weekend with that car to some kind of car trade show. These 80 nights, Comic Cons, different kind of cons.
And that's like the New England,
version, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they have YouTube shows where people build the time machine, from spare parts, and there's there's blueprints about the time machine.
Yeah, this car had all of it. Had the whole dashboard, the same dashboard and all that.
Yeah, the time circuits and the Mr. Fusion.
I am bummed because, it's now the Simpson ride, which is great, but for years when I first got to L.A., like the first 10 years out there, Universal had the Back to the Future ride, which was the first motion ride that I've been on, and I can't do those, but I did it anyways just because it was pretty awesome.
I was fortunate enough to go to Universal. I was unfortunate to experience the Back to the Future ride myself. I will, though, give a shout-out to our good friend Steve.
Ah.
Who has been to the Universal Studios, who did go on the Back to the Future ride, and is probably as big a Back to the Future fan as I am.
That's saying a lot. Does he have the and I'm pointing for all yous listening to all yous guys listening to the podcast.
All you lovers out there.
I mean, Joe does. He has quite an impressive display. It is. Come on.
It's a shelf.
Take a skate around. But what, how many DeLoreans are up there? Five?
No, so I have a friend.
Close, trace, quattro.
Cinco. Bam, 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 bam.
And the boxes that it came in.
Yeah, so a friend of mine years ago, actually, in return for a favor I did for him, he gifted me the three Back to the... He was a collector himself, and he gifted me those three Back to the Future DeLoreans from parts 1, 2, and 3. I also have the Lego Back to the Future DeLorean, which is a little disappointing, but it did come with Marty McFly and Doc Brown Lego figures. I have a couple of Back to the Future action figures that were recently released. I think it's called Reaction is the name of the company that puts these out. I have action figures of Doc Brown and Marty McFly. I have a box of the the assembly required plastic model of the DeLorean up there. I have the unwrapped, sealed Back to the Future VHS tape. I have the Back to the Future Nintendo game, which is awful. Little fun fact about the Back to the Future Nintendo game: the company couldn't license the song "Power of Love." It has this annoying sound that plays throughout the entire game. It goes da 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 da, and it just goes over and over and it loops. What I recently discovered within the last couple of years, thanks to YouTube, is that if you slow down that music, it's the Power of Love, only sped up like 8 times fast.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, you sons of bitches.
You little.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still an awful game, but it's all we had at the time. But it was funny that, oh, okay, so there's a reason why that incessant song is just you know, permeating that entire game. It's like they couldn't think of a better tune, a catchier tune, which, by the way, is a little lazy. It's like, okay, we coded the song Power of Love to 8-bit, but we don't have the license to use it at the regular speed. So instead of just coming up with a different tune, let's just speed up the old song and nobody will notice.
That is hysterical.
Yeah, and what else do I have Back to the Future up there? And, you know, like a couple other DeLorean-ish type things. But, it's modest. I think what I don't have is the like 1/16th size Back to the Future that glows, Back to the Future DeLorean that glows and makes the sounds. I don't think, you know, I have to draw the line at some point.
And we've talked about this at length on the podcast before, and I am truly happy to bring it back up again because it made me so giddy happy. Joe has successfully indoctrinated his oldest son into this world, into which the two of them were part of the crowdsourced Boston Back to the Future recreation this past summer.
That's right. So my son plays Marty McFly in a scene, and it's the scene where Marty first enters the 1955 square in Hill Valley, and Mr. Sandman is playing in the background, and it's a fun scene. I think just like you with Batman. Or are you with Star Trek and Star Wars?
I have no life, is what you're saying. Yeah,
no, but you have to, you know, as soon as your kids can open their eyelids and keep them open for a steady amount of time, you're putting them in front of those movies. I did the same with Back to the Future.
And it's paid off.
Yes, tenfold. and I'm going to do the same with you with Back to the Future Part 3, so don't think you're going anywhere.
I am looking forward to it. So number one is the first one, end-all, be-all, favorite movie.
Right.
Number two, if it comes on cable, you might sit down and watch it.
I mean, it's honestly, and that's another thing is that, by the way, these are all three movies are about the past. Like,
oh, that's right.
Yeah, you know, we're past the point of no return. It's 2018, bitches. So they're all like historical
documents. Don't date the podcast.
Right. I would never date the podcast. What was I going to say? The movies are constantly played in marathon lengths on myriad of those basic cable channels. Even HBO will play the unedited, you know, Back to the Future movies in succession on the marathon nights. They are great. Just like that whole universe. By the way, the popular show Rick and Morty.
Yes, yes.
Were Doc and Marty parodies.
And you know, my niece, she loves it. And my niece and nephews, who are about the same age as my guys, like the show, and I don't want to let them watch that. I let them watch some stuff, but it's hard for me to tell them, yes, it looks like Back to the Future, but it's not Back, you know.
It's a little bit more adult. And then another thing that I'm remembering is that last year at the Museum of Science, they had the Pop Culture of Technology exhibit, in which I got to physically see a DeLorean up front again. But then I also got to see the behind glass case, of course, props from the movie, you know, like the actual hoverboard that they use, the actual remote control that was used to control the original Back to the Future car from the first movie, the weird kind of erector set soup strainer thing that Doc Brown from 1955 wears on his head to read your thoughts. Yeah, it's just great that it's The geeks now literally do control like everything in pop culture. Like I said earlier at the top of the podcast, Ready Player One is a movie by Steven Spielberg who, by the way, executive produced Back to the Future, that heavily references, you know, the DeLorean, but it's like this future in which everybody has to enter the Oasis, which is this Matrix virtual reality world, where you can create things out of your own imagination and make it real. And there's a lot of pop culture, and Back to the Future is a big part of it. But yeah, I don't think you can see a DeLorean now and not think Back to the Future.
No.
Well, you can't see a DeLorean now anyway. If you did, you can't not think about Back to the Future. And then the one final thing, the soundtrack. Not the best soundtrack, but let's just put it out there. Probably, and Jacques would probably agree, probably not the best band ever assembled, a very competent band, but Huey Lewis and the News.
The News? Yeah. Wait. The band itself, the News? How dare you besmirch the good name, sir? How dare you?
Hey, Fox has besmirched the News for some time now.
If I was going to say, if there was a cover band, a Huey Lewis and the News cover band,
there is.
Would it be called fake news? See, and the and it was at the Fox,
hey-o!
And then you came right around, and then you put the
Yeah, there actually is a Back to the Future cover band called The Power of Love. It was funny. I was actually at a Huey Lewis concert on my birthday several years ago with our friend Jim. You know, we were just grabbing drinks, and I walked by a guy who had a black T-shirt on that said something on it that looked like the Back to the Future logo, and I go, "Hey, nice shirt." And like he points at it and says, "The Power of Love." And I'm like, "Oh, what's that?" He goes, "Oh, it's my cover band. We're a Huey Lewis in the News cover band." And they're a competent cover band, apparently. But they are out there. But long story short, Huey Lewis in the News was big in 1983-84. This movie put them in the stratosphere for that summer, especially. That song probably paid for many of Huey Lewis's lavish expenses and extravagant lifestyles. But I don't know. Yeah, Back to the Future, man. It's just like, yeah, I've just it opened up my imagination to like just like what Star Wars did for you and Back to the Future did for me, for better or worse. It didn't make me, you know, make wise choices throughout my entire life so that I wouldn't have to dream of going back in time to correct those mistakes. No. That's so stupid. But I am working on a time machine.
Well, seriously, thank you for indulging me. Thank you for putting the alert on.
Yeah, and then if you could just have a seat right over there, I'll get Back to the Future warmed up in the VHS.
Just going to go check this thing in my car. VHS. If you got out the laser disc of it, I am sold. But as always, you know, give Joe or the show a follow on Twitter or Facebook. And if,
where can they find us?
They can find us at OptiGrabber on the Twitter or on Facebook. It is Carnival Podcast. Same on Twitter. It's Carnival Podcast. If you want to follow me, don't, because it's mostly me.
The Jacques Four
saying Bloatus is awful and look at all this Dennis Reagan stuff. any suggestions for geeky stuff that Joe or I might know about or can pretend to know about, let us know. And last thoughts, Joe?
Do not forget!